shows that the electorate favors you over Governor Agnew by 17 points. This is the same poll that shows Hubert Humphreys trailing Richard Nixon by 5 points. How do you account for this considerable discrepancy in the feeling about running mates?
Oh, you can get all kinds of interesting sidelights on polls. I noticed in this poll this morning that 24% of those who support the vice president don't support me.
Why do you suppose that is? Where?
Because people are different.
Well, apparently they feel the candidates are different. What difference do you think?
Well, the poll pits, you're talking about apples and oranges. The presidency involves Mr. Wallace, Mr. Nixon, Mr. Humphrey. Harris poll on the second spot involves me, Mr. Agnew, and Mr. LeMay. I don't know how you can compare the two. You don't put me against Nixon or against Wallace. And I'm delighted if the poll shows that I'm contributing something to the strength of our ticket. But you try to go much beyond that and analyzing two different polls, and I think you're going to get yourself involved in some rather dizzy mental gymnastics.
Thanks. Senator Muskie, how is the candidacy of George Wallace affected what you're doing here in Massachusetts and what you're doing tomorrow in Connecticut?
Well, I've been against George Wallace.
Are you doing anything in particular, though, to get votes that might otherwise be going to him?
Same thing I've done everywhere else, try to point out the dangerous implications of the Wallace candidacy for all Americans. And I think that's true here in Massachusetts, as it has been elsewhere. I think he represents, what he's preaching, is just alien to everything America stands for or has ever stood for. We've always believed in a united, growing, open society. He believes in appealing to fear and hatred and is preaching division. That's the way to weaken America, divide America, not to strengthen it. And I don't think that Americans, when they really focus upon what he means, is going to buy it.
Senator Muskie, do you think George Wallace was out of order yesterday talking about unannounced concessions from Hanoi instead of the Russian and the
Americans? Well, on yesterday I said I think all I want to say about it.
Can I ask you another question then?
Oh, yes.
Do you think it was right that the two black athletes should have been suspended from the Olympic Games?
You know, when you're running for the vice presidency, you're supposed to be an expert about everything. I haven't really investigated the situation to come up with the facts. I gather that the young Negro athletes in question, without saying anything, by their attitude, registered some kind of a protest. Probably should not have been made under the circumstances in which they found themselves, but they were given no hearing with a view to determining exactly what they had in mind or what they were trying to express. I don't know what the rules of conduct the Olympic Committee had to govern such situations or what prescribed penalties, if any, there were. So it's a little difficult to pass any judgment on the action taken.
Senator, you're an expert I know on air and water pollution. Do you think this should play a more important role in the country?
Well, we can't get anybody to say they're against cleaning up water pollution. Since we enacted the landmark legislation in the last 5 or 6 years, almost everybody is cleaning it up. You have to look back in their records to know what their real attitude may be. For example, in the administration of which Mr. Nixon was a part, there was a veto of a bill to increase our annual investment in water pollution control from $50 to $90 million. The $90 million is grossly inadequate, and yet that bill was vetoed, and Mr. Nixon has never repudiated it. And that seems to be one test applied to candidates for the presidency who were formerly vice presidents, whether or not they repudiate what their presidents did. And he said he's willing to be fully accountable for the actions and the policies of that administration. Well, that's one clue. and Mr. Nixon's attitude.
Senator Muskie, sometime back you said you thought it would be tragic if the election were not settled on November the 5th. I wonder if you thought, in the meantime, some way you can, various candidates can ensure that it will be settled.
I think the only people who can settle the election on election day are the voters.
Well, I was thinking of if none of the three candidates got what would translate into an electoral majority, do you feel that they should do something?
Well, we're doing all we can between now and November 5th. I don't think that anything the candidates do is going to can be a substitute for the failure of the American people to reach a decision on November 5th. Well, I know all the gimmicks that you're referring to. Until you see what the result is, I don't think it's possible to say in advance what a candidate ought to do, but what the people haven't yet done.
How do you feel that Governor Wallace's choice of Curtis LeMay for his running mate has affected your candidacy and your campaign in states that were generally regarded as hostile before the choice?
Well, I don't know. When the last Harris poll on the vice presidential race was taken when Mr. Wallace didn't have a candidate, and even when he didn't have a candidate, vice presidential candidate on his ticket got 8%. In other words, the non-candidate got 8%, and Mr. LeMay got 16% today. I don't know what that means. Well, my guess is that up to now, the LeMay thing hasn't materially changed Mr. Wallace's stand in the polls. Visible movement attributable to that I can see. I know a great many people are disturbed about the general's attitude toward the nuclear weapon, but I think those same people were disturbed about Wallace generally. I don't know whether the people who were supporting Wallace before that time were troubled by the May selection. I just have no basis for that.
General Wallace
went
to come back from South Vietnam. Do you think that was a wise move at this point
with
the delicate negotiations going on?
Wise for the country?
I'm sorry, General
Lane. You mean wise
for the country?
Yes. Well, an awful lot of people always going over there. I don't know that you can stop them, especially if they're a vice presidential candidate.
Senator, can you give us your maturity? Can you give us a brief appraisal of your ticket situation as you see it in the New England states, the five New England states?
Well, that's one of the reasons I'm coming into New England to find out. I don't become an instant expert on the situation in the state the first moment I arrive. Congressman Boland and Senator Donahue are very optimistic from what they told me on the drive in, but I have no personal basis as yet for evaluating the situation.
Have you been briefed at all on the recent Vietnam speculation that there will be a bombing pause? That's the rumor going on. Can you shed any light on that?
I was briefed.
That's all you can say about it?
Yes.
When was the most recent?
Well, let's see. You know, I lose track of the days.
Was it last Wednesday?
Was that the last day I was
on my telephone?
No, it wasn't by telephone. Whatever day in midweek, I was in Washington last. I don't remember.
Senator, Friday in Boston, Richard Nixon said that he trusted that the war would be brought to an honorable conclusion by the time the next president takes office. And I wonder what your response or reaction to that statement is.
Trusted is a rather vague word. I wouldn't try to interpret it. I don't know what he meant.
Well, Senator, do you feel that puts the onus on the president administration to end the war by then?
Seems to me that for two or three years the pressure has been on the administration to end the war. I don't think adding the word trusted by Mr. Nixon adds to the pressure.
As really a
point
of strategy on his part.
Well, I get no reaction to what he said.
What issues have been affected for you as you travel around? What do you mean for
them? Well, that's a hard question to answer. I've tried to emphasize the need in this campaign for the American people to decide to trust each other, trust other Americans, however different they were, wherever they live, whatever their origin. That unless we could bring ourselves to do this, we can't really hope to deal with the difficult problems we face here at home. And I find that people respond to that message everywhere I go. I've hit very hard at the threat of the Wallace candidacy. And again, the audiences seem to respond to that message. There are a lot of things we talk about. We talk about the Nixon record. And in partisan audiences, at least, that generates considerable applause from time to time. How it may be influencing public opinion is difficult to say. You know, I don't really have any built-in polling resources that give me instant analyses of the impact of my visits in these areas. That's a tough kind of question to answer. All I can suggest is that you look at the polls, and if there's movement there, presumably there's approval of what I've said. But to analyze it, it takes these pollsters weeks, years after an election to break down the specific appeals that had an impact. And you asked me to do it off the top of my head, it's a little difficult to do.
You can analyze your appeals to you.
Well, on the campuses, they've been, by and large, apparently very friendly and even enthusiastic. At the beginning, I was unknown, as I was to most Americans. As I become more known, they seem to be friendlier and more enthusiastic. You know, it's a little difficult to ask a modest New Englander questions like that.
Senator, you saying that playing essentially the same theme Wallace has decided to fix his endorsements around Maryland and Mac Rafferty. Are you saying that he's bidding for racist votes?
Well, those are your words. He's trying to get to the votes of the same people that Wallace is getting, and Mr. Thurmond in the South proclaims himself to be Mr. Nixon's spokesman, and at the same time he says he has no quarrel with Mr. Wallace. Mr. Nixon must be aware of that, and so I assume that it's with his approval that Mr. Thurmond is using that line to appeal to those who might be inclined to vote for Mr. Wallace. Now, those are the facts. I don't like to put labels on them. I like to deal with the facts. You fellows are much better at writing the headlines than I am.
Shall we have time for one more question?
Senator, in the light of the allegedly delicate stage of the Paris talk, would you go so far as to say that you'd like to see some kind of a moratorium on Vietnam discussion by the candidates?
Well, I think this is for each candidate to decide in his own conscience.
Thank you, Senator.
Thanks.
An invitation like that, I wish I were about 30 years younger. Yes, I remember Bucksport. Thank you, Eddie Bolin, Mayor Friedman, Sheriff John Curley, Senator Donahue, and my good friends of the great Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I can't tell you how delightful it is to be back in New England. I found Americans from coast to coast to be warm and friendly and one people. But it's still good to get back in your own region of the country and to feel at home again in the fall when the colors are bright and the spirits are lifting. And I'll say to you that the spirits of Democrats are lifting all across this great country and they've got enough left to take us to victory on November 5th. It's always good also to be welcomed so warmly and enthusiastically by such a good friend and great congressman as Eddie Bolin. You know, like all of us, he puts it on a little thick, but it sounds so good. And it seems to me that that's the way of Massachusetts politicians down through the years. You know, up in Maine, we say that kind of praise for funerals. But this isn't a funeral year. Well, I've had a lot of fun talking to people across this country. And I find that you talk to them about the same things, whether they're maniacs from my state, or Californians, or Arkansans, whatever they are, they're interested in the same thing. Jack Kennedy understood that in 1960, when he pledged to get the country moving again. And he did get the country moving again, with the result that every American today is better off, has a brighter future, a more secure old age, greater educational opportunities than in 1960. I think that as we look at what America is like today, we ought to look not only at America's problems, but America's strength. Because really a problem can be evaluated and analyzed best in terms of our capacity to deal with it. And the fact is that here within the borders of our country, we've accumulated over the 180 years of our history the greatest potential for improving the lives of all Americans, the greatest potential for good in the world that God has ever permitted to assemble within the borders of one country in the entire history of man. However you measure it, by our economic strength, by our productive capabilities, by our educational complex, in terms of the confidence of our people in their abilities and talents and their capacity for managing the world's greatest economy, whether you measure it by our practice in the arts of freedom for 180 years, we are the greatest country in terms of our capacity to do good for our own fellow Americans, as well as to influence the course of mankind toward peace and justice that history has ever recorded. Now, sure, we have problems. We have difficult problems. We've got the kind of problems that have always been associated with crowded cities. Throughout the history of man, crowded cities have created problems. Because in crowded cities, there are unacceptable living conditions for too many people. Deteriorated environment, deteriorated air, deteriorated water, crowds which make the individual citizen feel less significant. Those who created this country understood that. Thomas Jefferson said that when we began to pile ourselves upon one another, as they do in Europe, we began to eat one another, as they do in Europe. Because in a crowded society, especially in a day of great industrialization and technological advance, makes the individual feel less significant, makes the individual less able to influence the forces which shape his own life. And if he finds himself in a situation where there appears to be no hope for escaping intolerable conditions, he's going to rebel against that kind of a society. And this has been the history of mankind. And you know, in the past, when any society has faced this kind of a problem, of a lot of people who are affluent and who have their stake in society, and others who have not. When other societies have faced this kind of condition, their answer has been to build a wall between those who are well off and those who are not. Those of us who have roots in Europe understand this, because in the countries from which we came, that answer has been tried. Building walls to protect the affluent, those who have a stake, against those who do not. And what has history's answer always been? The answer has always been that fear grows on both sides of the wall, that hatred grows on both sides of the wall, that violence grows on both sides of the wall, and the outcome is that there isn't safety and security for anybody on either side of the wall. I say the founders understood this. Jefferson told us that you can have law and order in a society only when every member of it has a stake in it. He also told us that you can't have law and order built on ignorance, indigence, and oppression. And yet we're being told in this campaign by a candidate for president who shows incredible support, considering his message in the polls, we're being told that the way to build security for those who already have a stake is to divide themselves off from those who do not. A candidate who appeals to fear, who stimulates hatred, who argues for division in America. Well, that isn't the way we've grown. As I look around these faces in this audience, we are all here because of people who came here from Europe seeking opportunity. They didn't come here looking for fear. They came here to escape it. They didn't come here looking for hatred. They came here to escape it. They didn't come here looking to deny others opportunity. They came here looking for opportunity which they understood was available to everyone. 40 million of them, immigrants, looking for freedom, for opportunity, for a stake in life, and they found it. This is the lesson of America. The lesson of our country is that we've grown because we've been open. We've grown because we've opened our arms to those who wanted to come in. And as they came in, they brought with them intelligence, skills, talents, cultures from other lands. They've enriched America and made America strong because America was willing to receive them. That's why in the year 1968, we're strong. That's why in 1968, we're great. That's why in 1968, more Americans are living better than grassroots citizens have ever lived in the entire history of man. Why then are we worried? We're worried because not all Americans are so fortunate. We're worried because our cities aren't governed effectively. We're worried because there's unrest among the young, among the black, among the poor whites who have not yet made their stake. Well, what's the answer to problems like that? The answer is to build an even stronger, more prosperous America, so that we can hold out opportunity to every American, whoever he is. You don't build freedom in a great country by contracting, by dividing, by fearing, by hating. We mean to have a society which is safe,
We mean to have one that's secure. We mean to have one that holds out opportunity for every American. We mean to build a society which will be better tomorrow than it is today, because that is important. It's important to our people. It's important to our children. And it's an important asset in the war for peace and justice around this globe. Have you ever wondered why this country has been given these blessings? Why us instead of any other country? Why us in this time? Is it accidental? Does it have no purpose? Is it simply for the purpose of accumulating material goods and enjoying material things? Or did somebody have a higher purpose that we haven't yet served? In my judgment, that's the reason that we were made a great country, because we face a great task. And that task is to build a peace and justice here at home and to help build peace and justice around the globe. If that isn't the task, if that isn't the purpose, then there is no purpose. There is no purpose if that isn't it. Jack Kennedy understood that, and he said it in so many of those eloquent speeches which still haunt us down through the corridors of time, that the great objective of free men is to make free men better. The great purpose of free men is to help make others free. And by freedom, we mean not only freedom from tyrannical governments, but freedom from those conditions around us, environmental and economical, which limit the capacity of any individual to improve himself. That's what we mean by freedom in the United States of America. We mean freedom from fear, freedom from hate, freedom from discrimination, freedom from prejudice, freedom from division. That's the only way to be free, and the answer to it is within each of us. We can't create that kind of freedom by passing a law in Washington. All we can do in Washington is to serve your purposes by giving you the tools with which to shape the environment and the economy, the educational system, which make it possible for freedom to flourish. But the meaning of freedom, the willingness to accept freedom for others as well as ourselves, has to be within ourselves. And that's the big issue of this campaign. Whether or not Americans are really willing to trust other Americans, whoever they are, wherever they live, whatever their color, whatever their origin, whatever their conditions of life. And trust means willing to trust the weak as well as the strong. Even to trust a man who might be evil in the hope that he might be made good. It means even trusting those who lash out blindly against unacceptable conditions, against friends who are trying to help them. That's what trust means. And it's only on the basis of trust that a free society can survive. Once that breaks down, we've lost what we've built. So the decision in this election year is going to be made in your hearts, in your minds, in your courage, in your determination to live with work with, cooperate with, and build with all other of the 200 million Americans who occupy this great continent with their great potential for good here at home and overseas. And I know that this is how you view America, because it is here where John Kennedy had his roots, and he couldn't have been what he was unless you were the same. Thank you very much, and as we go ahead in this fight, God bless you all. Over 14 years, that I tend to take it for granted, but I know I shouldn't here in Massachusetts, and I wanted to say thank you to him for his most generous introduction. Of governing our cities. We face the problem of making America a place in which all kinds of people, different kinds of people, can live together in harmony. This kind, or these kinds of problems, are the kinds of problems that Americans have worked with since this country began 180 years ago. When we began this system, our objective, the objective of the founders of our country, was to create a country in which every citizen could build a better life for himself and for his children. We've worked toward that objective ever since. We've not yet achieved it fully for every American. And yet we've come closer to it than we ever did before. We've come closer to it than any society ever has before. We've made remarkable strides since John Kennedy campaigned for the presidency in 1960. You'll remember one of the things that he said in his inaugural address. He said, "If a free society cannot help the many who are poor, it cannot save the few who are rich." But what he said was also said 180 years ago by Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson said that the only way you can have law and order in any society is to build a society in which every citizen has a stake. You cannot, he said, build a society on ignorance, indigence, and oppression. Now that's the ideal that Americans have worked for and fought for and struggled for 180 years. It is that ideal that brought my father and so many of those who account for your being here to this country. People who came here to escape fear. People who came here to escape hatred. People who came here not to deny opportunity to others, but to seek opportunity for themselves, which they understood was available to everybody. And so in the last of the last century, and in the first of this century, 40 million immigrants came to this country looking for freedom, looking for opportunity, looking for ways to build a stake for themselves. And because America was a land of the free, they found what they came for. Now, they didn't find it right away. My father and others who came here did not find instant equality. They did not find opportunity
freely available. They had to struggle for it. But the point is that this was a free, open, growing country whose ultimate objective was to create a stake in it for every citizen. And so these 40 million Americans who came from overseas and their descendants have made a place for themselves in this country. And in this year, 1968, we're all better off than our ancestors in the old country could ever have dreamed possible for any one of us. And in the process of taking in these strangers from outside, America has become stronger, more prosperous, and richer in every way. Because these immigrants brought their skills, as yet undeveloped, but developed them with the schools and the training that was available here. They brought with them their own dedication to the idea of liberty and freedom. They brought with them their rich cultural heritage from overseas. And so they've enriched America. And America, as a result, has gone strong. No country in the entire history of man has ever had the strength to make life better for all its people than do we here in the United States in 1968. No country in the entire history of man has ever had the strength to work for peace and justice around the world that we have in 1968. And it's odd, it seems to me, that at this moment in our history, in the history of man, when we have this great strength, there should be so many Americans who begin to doubt it. There's no reason to doubt it. We're in a better position to deal with the problems of the disadvantaged, to deal with the problems of the different races, to deal with the problems of our cities, to deal with the problem of cleaning up our air and cleaning up our water than we've ever been before. We're at a moment of great strength here in America, and the only thing that weakens us is the doctrine of those who say you must build a wall between those who already have a stake in our society and those who do not. Now, we know from the countries of our origin that when you build a wall between people, you create fear on both sides, you create hatred on both sides, and you create violence on both sides. Because as Jack Kennedy says, if a free society cannot provide for the many who are poor, it cannot save those who are rich or affluent. And so all we have to decide to do to solve the problems that face us here in this election year of 1968 is to determine to work for each other, all of us, to trust each other, all of us, to continue to build an open, growing, expanding society. Because as we build our economic strength, and that's what we've done in the last 8 years, we increase our capacity to deal with the problems of the disadvantaged. We increase our capacity to build schools, to build industries, to create opportunity, not only for those who already have it, but for those who do not. That's the American tradition. That's been the American road, and that's what we're going to do in this year, 1968. We're going to build what Jack Kennedy dreamed we could build, the kind of a country in which every American, whatever his color, race, national origin, or region, can hope for a better life for himself and for his children. That's our objective, and we're going to reach it with your help. Thank you very much. God bless you all.
Americans have an undertaking to drive hatred and violence against the out of America. For 180 years, we've been trying to build on this continent.
open, growing country in which everybody has a chance. Now, I see here in this square faces originating in the same land from which I originated. And there are others, the Irish, the Italians, the Poles, the Venezuelans. Oh, yes, I know the Wallace people. I remember them. I remember them or their forebears back in the 20s up here in New England when they fought against everything that came from Europe. They didn't like us then. They didn't like us then, and they don't like us now. What they're trying to do is to divide us, to stir up our divisions, to stimulate fear, to stimulate hatred, and to divide our country in order that their man might get a little power. Well, we're not going to let them do it. Because my father didn't come to this country to find what they're teaching. He came here to find freedom. He came here to find opportunity, not only for himself, but for all Americans. And that isn't the kind of America that Wallace would like to build if he were elected president. So let's just let him know on November 5th that there's no place in America for the kind of message he's been spreading from coast to coast in this country. The kind of America that we have come to learn, you Irish, we Poles, you Italians. The kind of America that we have come to love is the kind of America that opens its arms to the Poles and the Italians and the Irish and all who seek opportunity in this country. And in the process, we've given something to America. We've given to America the intelligence we brought with us, the innate skills that we brought with us, the talents we brought with us, and more than that, the deep love of freedom that we brought with us. We've enriched America with that. More than that, we brought to America the rich heritage of Ireland and Italy and Poland and Lithuania and all of these cultures from Europe, which have been melded together and have strengthened America in the process. It's been a two-way street. America has given us freedom and opportunity, and we have given America strength. That's the way America has grown, and that's why. In this year of 1968, we are at the pinnacle of our capacity to provide opportunity for all Americans. This year, 1968, represents the point of maximum strength which we've achieved in 180 years of American history. And what's made it possible? It's because all these Americans, and you know all of us, are descendants of immigrants, because all these Americans have found it possible, notwithstanding their differences, to work together, to cooperate together, to build the greatest industrial machine the world has ever known, to build here the greatest opportunity for improvement for the average citizen that the world has ever known here. And there's no reason for us to do anything but to go forward doing exactly what we've done for 180 years, to open up America to everybody who wants to contribute to this great and wonderful land of ours. Now I'd like to touch up Mr. Nixon just a little bit. Did you hear that? This young lady said Mr. Nixon needs a lot of touching up, not just a little. Well, we just touched up Mr. Wallace a little bit. Let's touch up Mr. Nixon. And then I want to say something about Mr. Humphrey. Is that all right? Yeah. Mr. Nixon is a very interesting man.
He's a hypocrite.
He hasn't won an election on his own since 1948. Or he won a couple riding Ike's coattails, but he hasn't won one on his own since 1948, and there's a good reason why. And I'd like to tell you why. He served in the Congress of the United States as a congressman and as a senator for 6 years. And he accomplished so little in that 6 years that he doesn't even boast about it on his campaign literature. In his reference here to his career in the Congress, he doesn't list a single accomplishment. And when a candidate doesn't do that for himself, how much credit should we give him? Then from 1952 to 1960, he was vice president. And in the last part of that period, when his president was asked, what contribution has Mr. Nixon made to your administration? The president said, give me a week and I might think of something. And now about this campaign. Mr. Nixon is conducting the most negative, uncreative, non-productive campaign that I can recall in my lifetime. Here is a year when we've got some tough problems. We got the problem of the wall. We got the problem of our city. We got the